Well, we're studying the Gospel of Mark in chapter 6, and I don't like to do this very much, but we will do it a little bit this morning, looking at the other accounts in Matthew and John, because it is very, very helpful to us. Jesus had fed the 5,000, and according to the Gospel of John, chapter 6, it threw the crowds into somewhat of a frenzy of messianic expectation. They wanted to take him there and then and make him king. Maybe some of them were thinking along the lines, if he can miraculously multiply bread and fish, if he is a prophet from God, if he can supersede, if you like, the natural laws that govern each and every other human being on earth, could he multiply gold to really finance a war effort against the Roman occupation? Could he multiply gold or money so that we can go and get a number of surrounding nations and we could really stand up against Roman occupation and kick them out so that once again we as Israelites can be a supreme nation in the geographical position and place in which they were? Could he not just multiply food as well? That would be very helpful, wouldn't it, for us? They had this expectation, they had this promise from the Old Testament that God was going to one day send them a king, and that king was, well, going to bless them, and if they really knew, well, he would not only bless them, but bless all the nations of the world. But they had a wrong expectation of what kind of king he was going to be, a wrong expectation of what kind of kingdom God was going to bring. And so when they saw him miraculously providing for 5,000, they really want to hail him as king. Now you would have thought, well, the whole of the New Testament talks about Jesus as a king. You would have thought, well, that's exactly what Jesus would have wanted. Well, in one sense, he does want us to acknowledge him as king. He does want us to enthrone him, if you like, upon the seat of our hearts so that we love him and worship him and confess him as king so that he becomes the Lord of our minds and our hearts, our lips and our lives, our wallets and our time and everything else. But his kingdom is a spiritual kingdom, as we'll see this morning, not a physical and a visible one. And so he takes charge of the situation. He hurriedly pushes the disciple into a boat and says, you go over, I'll catch up a little bit later on. And he disperses these crowds, doesn't he? He goes off alone, as we know the Gospel of Luke. We studied that. He's doing that again and again and again, isn't he? Maybe the crowds now wanting to make him king. We know that Jesus is a man and he's tempted in all ways as we are, yet remains without sin. The book of Hebrews reminds us. Maybe he thinks, now I need to get away. What's going to happen? How am I going to stay the course and go to the cross if there's all these great temptations for all of the people to make me king without the cross? And maybe he's feeling tempted. Maybe he's got some questions. So he sends the disciples away. He disperses the mob. He goes off to a quiet and silent place alone to pray for strength, for wisdom, for guidance, and for all of the things that we as human beings are utterly dependent upon God for. We won't make much of it, but it reminds us that we need to do the same, don't we? If Jesus did the same, we as believers, we need to get alone with God on a regular basis, don't we, to seek him. And it's good to have prayer meetings and this, that, and the other, but we need that time alone, don't we? Whether it's just 5 or 10 minutes in the morning and the evening on a regular basis, or extra times where there's an hour or two where we set aside to really seek the Lord for various things with an open Bible, thankfully, that we are privileged to have in our day and in our age. Well, we have a flurry of miracles, and I think that's what Mark wants us to see. That's what the other gospel writers want us to see. Now, he sends the crowds away. There's just been the only miracle that's recorded in all four gospels, but now there's just a flurry of miracles as Jesus himself walks upon water, and then he calls Peter out of the boat and enables Peter to miraculously walk on water, as we'll see in the book of Matthew. He then stills the storm, as he did earlier on in the Gospel of Mark as well, and then immediately the boat is on the shore, and as soon as he gets there, we see all of these miracles of healing as well. So he's reminding us again and again of who Jesus is. So first heading for us this morning is Jesus walked on water. We have to ask ourselves, if he can walk on water, why does he leave it to the fourth watch and to 3 a.m. in the morning to the point that they're utterly exhausted and virtually giving up on life? Well, as we're going to hear this evening in the book of Hebrews, he teaches us through the storms of life. The crowds have got it all wrong about who Jesus is. And maybe the disciples, as well as we see here, because of hardness of heart, they don't understand the miracle. They haven't got it. So maybe the crowds are thinking, we want a kingdom of bread and food and gold and the removing of Roman occupation. We want a visible kingdom where there is gold and freedom and prosperity and food and all those kinds of things. And it looks as if the disciples haven't got it, and they're kind of like, that's what Jesus has come to do. That's what the charismatic movement is about, isn't it? That Jesus is here to make you rich and happy and prosperous and to heal you and deliver you from all trials and tribulations. And a good ripe old age, you'll just suddenly, bing, in your sleep maybe, enter into heaven. Well, that's not the way things work. Paul tells us very clearly that through much tribulation, we must enter the kingdom of heaven. All those who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And Jesus says, in the world you will have tribulation. And so the crowds and the disciples are discussing, and you can try to imagine something of the conversation as they get into the boat. Maybe they're saying, right, as soon as we get the other side, and as soon as Jesus gets here, we're not messing about anymore, we're going to make him king, we're going to acknowledge him as King Messiah, and we're going to push him towards what we want him to do. And that's a great temptation as believers often, is to get hold of Jesus in a sense, not the Jesus of the Bible, the Jesus of our own imaginations, and say, Jesus, you're going to do that. You're going to bless my life, and you're going to give me this job, and you're going to give me that spouse, and you're going to make the path smooth me, and you're, as the king of the universe, as the one who can feed 5,000 and anything else you do, that's what you're going to do for me. Well, Jesus teaches the crowds and certainly the disciples here that that is not who he is and that is not what he has come to do at all. You can only imagine something of the conversation as they first get into the boat and the crowds are dispersed and Jesus walks off before they're caught in the midst of a storm. Do you really think he's the king? What do you think he can really do? We have seen him. We have just been sent out and given power to heal people and cleanse lepers and raise the dead. What has he come to really do? Who really is he? You can only imagine. And Jesus is drilling into them as he allows them to go to the point of exhaustion as they are rowing and they keep on rowing. He is drilling into them that his kingdom is not a kingdom of comfort and prosperity, of eating and drinking, but as the book of Romans reminds us, his kingdom is one of righteousness, peace, and joy. Of a righteousness that is received from Christ, that we are justified in the sight of God, and a kingdom where we walk in righteousness from that point of meeting Jesus, who is our righteousness, to peace throughout all of the storms of life, and joy no matter what the Lord gives us. That he has not come to set up a kingdom whose citizens are free from all difficulties. He's not come to set up a visible and a physical kingdom, but a spiritual and an eternal kingdom. He has not come to set up a kingdom like every other kingdom that is so full of lies and empty promises and spin and deception and corruption and everything else that characterizes every other kingdom that ever has or ever will be on the earth. He has not come, as we read in the book of Hebrews, to set up a shakeable kingdom, but an unshakeable and an eternal kingdom. He has not come to set up a temporal, localized, geographical kingdom, but a kingdom that ultimately gathers people from all of the ends of the earth that will receive a new heaven and a new earth and a universal eternal kingdom. That's what he's all about, isn't it? That's the gospel. That's who Jesus is. And that's what the scriptures mean when they talk about the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. So he lets them row and row and row and row. And at exactly the right time, not so early so they don't learn the lessons, but not too late that they perish, he comes to them walking on water, and their response, we're told, is that they are terrified. Yes, he can feed 5,000, but we're not expecting him to come and help us as we're nearly drowning again. Yes, he has stilled a storm when he was with us in the boat, but now he's encouraging that their faith would grow, that they would believe that he will save them and be, well, mindful of them and fulfill his work through them, even though he's not actually there. What's happening in your minds? What's happening in your hearts, Jesus is saying? I have stilled a storm when I was in the boat with you. I've sent you out and you've cleansed lepers, healed the sick, raised the dead. I have just fed 5,000 men and their families miraculously with virtually nothing. Do you not believe that I can come to you? Do you not believe that even if I don't come to you from wherever I am, I've sent you over to the other side, and to the other side you are going? Well, when they see him, they're not even expecting, they're not even asking for him, they're not even looking for him. So when they do seek him, they're terrified and they think it's some kind of a spirit or a ghost or something. Well, we're reminded that, yes, you can take something of the surface teaching of what the words are saying, but we need to dig beneath the surface as we did last time, and we see the Exodus motif again, as it's the time of the Passover. Jesus has arranged them into groups of 50 and hundreds, as exactly Moses did. He then miraculously feeds them so they're all satisfied and filled like Moses did under God in the wilderness with the manna. And well, wasn't it Moses that prayed and the Red Sea parted and they walked through the Red Sea, and when the Egyptians tried to do it, it engulfed and swallowed them up? It's the Exodus motif. Again, here is the one, the great leader, in a sense, that Moses pointed towards, that will provide for you, that will get you safely to the other side. So he walks upon water. Second point this morning is that he enables Peter to walk upon water. And you need to turn back to the Gospel of Matthew, admittedly, to chapter 14 and verses 28. And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink, he cried out saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they'd got into the boat, the wind ceased, we're told. "It is I," Jesus says, "do not be afraid." Maybe that's reminiscent of Moses meeting God at the burning bush and God saying, "I am." And in a sense, as he walks across the water, he's reminding them that he is the manna provider. He is the one who is the great leader that Moses pointed to. He is the one who will safely get us through the sea, if you like, to the other side. He is the one who can say, "I am," as he does again and again in the Gospel of John. "It is I." And when Peter hears these words, something happens. His faith engages. "If it is you, call me to come out." And Jesus does. You see, there's so many things going on, isn't there? Who is Jesus? The Exodus motif. But the way Jesus deals with us to cause us to grow spiritually is very much in the passage and the context, isn't it? He really wants them to grasp who he is and what his kingdom is like and what it means to walk with him and to trust him through all the storms and the difficulties and everything else of life. Okay, Peter, if you in a moment can turn from dread and terror and fear to say, if it is you, call me to come out. If you can walk on water, then you can enable me too to walk on water. Come out then. Let's see your faith in action. And he does. And we all know the story that Peter himself begins to walk on water. Not in his own strength, as later on Peter is going to do a number of miraculous things, as we see in the book of Acts, and we are told that in the early part of the church, these apostles did do miraculous things in the power of Christ. And by the miraculous power of Jesus, this man is enabled now to walk upon water. The creator of water, the creator of gravity, the creator of mankind, the creator of everything else that governs our universe becomes a man, walks on water, and can enable those who believe in him to do the same. And we all know the story that when his eyes were fixed on Jesus, he did well and he took one step after the other. I'm sure the first step itself was probably the hardest, but once the first step was felt that he didn't fall through, that encouraged his faith to take a second and a third. And well, I don't know whether he began to run, and we don't know exactly the distance, but certainly he was walking for a little bit of time. He seems to be at a distance, doesn't he, passing them by, tempting them to look out and cry out for him. And now he is calling Peter to walk on water, and he's doing it. And when his eyes are fixed on Jesus and his heart is filled with faith, when his faith, if you like, and his vision of Jesus supersedes the wind and the waves and overcomes the doubts and the fears, he's walking on water. But as soon as his eyes are taken off Jesus, as soon as his heart begins to doubt and his eyes are put upon the wind and the waves, we all know what happens. It's another picture, I think, as well. There's so many things going on here. There is the Exodus motif. There is the, this is Jesus who is God, the man, come into time and space to reveal God to us. Yes, on the surface. But the passage is also reminding us that when Moses led Israel through the Red Sea, where did they get to? Well, ultimately, they got to the promised land. That's where they were going. That's where they're heading. And it would have been a very short journey from the other side of the Red Sea into the promised land if they'd gone by God's directing. And in a sense, Jesus is sending them over to the other side, isn't he? And he's saying to us, yes, you will go through storms and trials and difficulties along the way. Yes, you will need to fix your eyes on me and believe in me. And if you do, not only will you get through the storm in a boat, you'll even miraculously get through the storm on foot. And you will get to the fulfillment of my kingdom. You're thinking about me as a king, and you're thinking about me and my kingdom. Well, this is what my kingdom is like. It is not of this world. He said that, didn't he, to Pilate? My kingdom is not of this world. And so we see Jesus, if you like, the creator of the universe, the one who can walk on water, enabling mankind to do the same. That he's telling us that there is a curse on you, and the wind and the waves and earth is rebelling against you, and the animals are rebelling against you, and you're rebelling against one another because you rebelled against me, your creator. But here is the one who supersedes the curse. Here is the one who supersedes the world in which we live in. Here is the one who is the ultimate superhero that makes Batman and Superman and the Fantastic Four look utterly pathetic. Pathetic in comparison. Here is the one who is actually worthy to be worshipped as the God-man, who can walk upon water and enable you to do so, reminding us that one day, all of the wind and all of the waves and all of the wildness of this world in which we live in that is cursed because of our sin will be utterly removed. And you will make it into God's everlasting kingdom. Now, I don't know whether Adam could have walked on water in the Garden of Eden, and I very much doubt that he would have been able to fly. But I do know that Adam would have lived in the Garden of Eden forever if we had not sinned. He was given a body that could have, humanly speaking, lived forever in the Garden of Eden. He was flesh and blood like me and you, and he would never have known cancer. He would have never have known sickness. He would have never have known pain. He would never have known death if he had remained in the garden. If sin had not come into the world, Adam and Eve and all of their descendants would still be in that garden, and nobody would ever get sick or ever die. And the reason why we get sick, and the reason why we die, and the reason why there's wind and waves and the animals are rebelling against us is ultimately because of sin. And what's happening here is God is saying to us, look, I'm sending you to the other side. I'm sending you to my eternal kingdom. And you know that when you get to the other side, there is peace. There is joy. There is no tears. There's no sorrow. There is no death. There is no sickness. There is no curse. And you can be assured of these things, that this isn't a fancy or a whim, pie in the sky nonsense like the superheroes we have in our modern day. You can know this is as real as well as you and me are sitting here this morning, in that Jesus has come and he walked on water and he enabled Peter to walk on water as well. Third thing we see this morning is that Jesus stilled the storm, didn't he? As you turn back maybe to the Gospel of Mark, immediately we are told he stills the storm. He's already done that. He is the Lord of creation, isn't he? He is the one who is not under a curse, who is subjected to all of the rebellion of the world around. But here is the one who is the Lord of creation, who is God incarnate, as we have heard again and again and again. Who is not subjected to creation, but creation is subjected to him, as he is the God and the Lord and the creator of this planet and even the entire universe. So when Peter gets back in the boat and the others are looking at Peter and see it, and then when Jesus gets back into the boat and the storm is stilled like that, well, Matthew's gospel tells us that the only thing that they can do, it's not say we want some kind of a temporal king, we want some kind of a human superhero. They just bow down and worship him. They are beginning to understand, aren't they? Even after they had been sent out and done a number of miracles, even after Jesus has fed 5,000, their hearts are still hard, we are told, and they do not understand. But now they're beginning to understand. And they actually worship him. John's gospel tells us that not only does Jesus walk on water, not only did he enable Peter to walk on water, not only did he still the storm with all of the lessons that are connected to that, but then the boat just seems to time travel and is immediately on the shore. So here is the one who supersedes creation. He supersedes time and space, doesn't he? He supersedes all of these things that he has created. And although we live in a dimensional universe and we're subject to those dimensions, here is one that is not subject to the dimensions, who really is the creator of time and space and everything else that is a reality to us as human beings. And the boat is immediately at land. It reminds us that he conquers space, time, and the elements. The wind and the waves obey him. Sickness and disease obeys him. Evil spirits obey him. We've had all of that in the Gospel of Mark already. But even time and space, he is Lord and ruler over it. And he can do instantly what they couldn't do in hours of rowing, is maybe the big lesson we're getting. He does alone what they couldn't do all together. It reminds us as a gathered church, doesn't it, that we can put in hours and years of effort, all of us together, and we won't succeed. But he does alone in a moment what all of them couldn't do in hours and hours and hours, to the point of exhaustion. And once they're safe over on the other side, they have time to think, don't they, about who he really is. That he is the only one that can bring us to heaven's perfect peace. He is the only one that can one day bring us safely to heaven's shores and the promised land, where all striving and all toiling and all laboring will cease, where all fear will be ended as he quells their fears, where all questions will be answered, all sicknesses will be healed, as we see in the Gospel of Mark. As soon as they get there, there's a flurry of healings and miracles as well. And in the meantime, as we pass through the storms and the difficulties of life, he will provide, he will care, and he will protect us. As we close this morning, looking again at a simple narrative that we have in the Sunday school and everything else, and we have looked in a few different angles and scratched beneath the surface, and you can see the whole kind of concept of creation, fall, and heaven motif there. You can see the whole Exodus motif there, and all the lessons that you can draw in there. You see the simple lesson in front of you that Jesus is the one who can calm a storm and walk on water and cause a boat to be immediately in another place and even cause human beings to do miraculous things. Let's ask ourselves, do you understand, or is your heart hardened? In verse 52 it says, for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. And we have to ask ourselves this morning, if you are an unbeliever, if you have not yet confessed Christ openly, if you are not publicly following Jesus, is it because your heart is hard? There's something wrong with you. It's not that you just lack a little bit of information. It's not that you just need to grow up a few more years. It's not that, well, the education system or politics or everything else is going to sort everything out and you're going to have everything you ever dreamed or wanted. No, 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 no. Only Jesus can answer all the problems and the trials of life. Only Jesus can get you through the storms of life safely to the other side. Only he is the king of an eternal, unshakable kingdom. And you need your heart to be softened, to understand him, to turn to him, and receive what he and he alone can give you. Jesus should be our ultimate superhero. Not an imaginary, mystical, fairy tale superhero in a naive way that children have in the comics and everything else today, but in the most rational, reasonable, intelligent, logical way, we know who he is. He is the hero of our hearts. We love him and worship him. They were greatly amazed, beyond measure, we're told. They're just amazed in verse 51. They were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure, and they marveled. And I know after years of being a Christian, it's difficult, isn't it? We know all of the texts. We know all of the stories. We've seen it all 1,000 times. And it's just so easy to lose that sense of wonder and amazement. I know for myself, I have to battle and fight and pray and read the Bible and remind myself again and again to be amazed at Jesus. So that I delight in praying, I delight in reading the Bible, I delight in coming to church, I delight in paying my tithes and offerings, I delight in all of the other things that he has asked me to do. I delight to do them. I delight to take up my cross and follow him because I'm trying to maintain a consistent sense of amazement and marvel at who Jesus is and what he has done for me. And we meditate on the cross and we think about heaven and we're mindful of his promises. And as we fix our eyes on Jesus and not the storms and the waves, it will help us, won't it? You see, we're English, aren't we? And I don't expect you to respond as the Africans do. The Africans, they shout and they scream and they say amen. And all of these things, we don't expect that amongst us as nice middle-class people in Suffolk in the 21st century. But I will challenge you, are you amazed at Jesus? Do you love him? Is this just something so foreign to you that when the disciples, they see these things, the calming of the storm and Peter getting out and the boat immediately being there and everything else, they're amazed by him. We should be, shouldn't we? I'm amazed at the cross. I'm amazed at the resurrection. I am amazed at where Jesus is right now. I am amazed at his promises. I am amazed at the place where I will go to God's eternal and unshakable kingdom. And if not, something's a little bit wrong. We need to hear Jesus, don't we, all the time, particularly you that are going through storms and difficulties. Be of good cheer. It is I. Don't be afraid. Maybe that's for you here this morning. Forget all the amazement. Forget all the creation motif. Forget all the heaven stuff, maybe. Forget all the Exodus motif. Forget everything else. Right now, you're going through such a storm that you almost can't see him, and all you can see is wind and waves bellowing on top of your life. Well, just hear Jesus say to you this morning, be of good cheer. It is I. Don't be afraid. And he isn't just a king as the crowds think or the disciples at the beginning. He is the king who will one day calm all storms and bring us safely into his everlasting kingdom on the other side. Now, if these things don't mean anything to you, there's something seriously wrong and you're hard-hearted and you need to go away and say, where am I with the living God? But there's something for us, isn't there? For us to think about at the dinner table, to think about late this afternoon, to think about during the week. I've spent an awful lot of time thinking about this and praying about this, and if it just goes in one ear and out the other, I feel like I'm wasting my time here. And I pray and hope that I'm not. Amen. Well, we close.